So good morning. Thank you all for coming again. I know it's the last day, so woo! I'm going to be talking a bit about a qualitative examination that we conducted with district court judges in North Carolina, because we were trying to examine how they decide to issue or deny domestic violence protection orders. And so I don't have any relationships to disclose. And before I start, I just really want to give a quick acknowledgement to the research team. I've been, for the past few years, had the pleasure of working with Dr. Beth Morocco on this topic area, and we've really been trying to create a lot more projects based around using domestic violence protection orders as a secondary prevention tool. And this is just our research team, so these are all the people that worked on this project. Highlighted my name for some reason. As we know, intimate partner violence is violence that's occurring within a relationship. It can be physical, psychological, or sexual. It's associated with a lot of negative health outcomes, including injury, depression, chronic illness, and post-traumatic stress disorder, and death. I have slightly higher statistics in North Carolina as well of that they're experiencing 35.6% of women are going to be experiencing intimate partner violence in their lifetime. So it's incredibly prevalent. And domestic violence protection orders offer us this opportunity to do some secondary prevention. And though primary prevention is very important, these civil protective orders offer women and men a way of protecting themselves from violent relationships. So domestic, how many people have heard about domestic violence protection orders? Just as a tool, I'm sure. Okay, just to gauge how in-depth I really have to go with this. But they're civil court orders. They're preventing contact between two partners. And it's offered in all 50 states, District of Columbia, and the territories in the United States. And there's evidence to suggest that your risk of intimate partner violence is going to significantly drop as the duration of a domestic violence protection order increases. And additionally, people who have domestic violence protection orders, though it is just like a piece of paper, which is what a lot of the judges were saying to us, they feel a lot more secure when they have that piece of paper in place because it gives them a way of really staying away from their partner and recourse if that partner continues to contact them. So the process in North Carolina of obtaining a domestic violence protection order is that first you're going to go and you're going to file for a temporary order. And the judge will typically, in 98% of the cases, grant you an ex parte, which means that the defendant doesn't have to be there. And this is an emergency or temporary order. So it lasts for about 10 days. And then you're going to come back for that permanent DVPO hearing, which is a 50B/10-day hearing. And this is where the judge is either going to grant, deny, or dismiss the order voluntarily or involuntarily. And these are the orders that are going to last for about a year. So they're 12 months, and they can be extended subsequently. And I know this is different on a state-to-state basis. This is just the process in North Carolina. What we noticed, because Beth Morocco had done a study trying to figure out what is associated, what risk factors are associated with getting that domestic violence protection order. And what she found was that it's supposed to be based on evidence, testimony, and state statutes. But it wasn't, when she did the study, she found that there was actually nothing was associated with the likelihood of getting this domestic violence protection order except for the judges, because they have almost complete autonomy when it comes to granting these orders. And nothing was really systematically popping up as being associated. So it wasn't based on the severity of intimate partner violence. There was just no factors, essentially, that really came to light in the study. So what we wanted to do was really figure out what do the judges think the factors are that are playing into their decisions, and then what role do heuristics play? So it's those cognitive rules that we use every day to kind of make quick decisions. So it's those mental shortcuts that because of the fact that they're faced with having to make these decisions in a very short period of time, often less than 15 minutes, we wanted to figure out, is this leading to systematic bias? Is this leading to these cognitive errors? So that's really what we were exploring in this study. So what we did was we wanted to do in-depth interviews with district court judges, which sounded really daunting, like, how are we going to get these judges? Luckily, we had a great champion. It was the former president of the district court, judges who emailed all of the judges and asked them to participate in the study. And we really wanted to try to get a snapshot across the state, so we took kind of an unorthodox qualitative approach in that we divided the 100 counties of North Carolina into tertiles based on the number of domestic violence protection order cases that they hear in a year. And we randomly then selected 54 district court judges. And from that sample of 54 court judges, we ended up doing 20 semi-structured interviews with these judges. And the analysis approach we took was much more kind of traditional in terms of qualitative research. We had some research assistants who were phenomenal, and they transcribed the audio verbatim. Each interview was about 30 minutes, and we used a semi-structured guide, and we did open coding by hand at first, and then we realized through writing analytic memos that it would be a lot easier if we just moved everything over to Atlas TI. And so we did a recoding in Atlas TI, and we really found some interesting emergent themes. Specifically, we found three things. For the judges, they need the violence to cross this internal threshold for them to feel that an order is necessary. Additionally, they talked extensively about the role that children play, and it's really this conflicting role that's I'll go into a bit more detail in a minute. And finally, they had a lot of reported anticipatory regret. And what we mean by that is that it's the regret that you feel now that you're going to regret a decision. So it's essentially that you're going to regret a decision you're making now in the future. So it's this feeling that I am worried that I made the wrong choice. So that's really anticipatory regret. So in terms of crossing a threshold, the judges reported that this violence needed to cross a line for them in order for them to feel that they could grant this order. It differed based on the judge that you talked to. They all had this internal threshold. But something that was really consistent across all of the judges was that if they saw physical evidence, they were, boom, I can grant this order. There's the physical manifestation. I feel very comfortable immediately granting this order. However, in the absence of that physical evidence, they would say that they had to do a personal assessment of how severe it was. And they had a lot of really unrealistic expectations of victims' behavior. They just expected them to behave in this way that they were just very afraid of the person who had perpetrated this violence against them. And as a lot of us know through the research, victims don't behave in a really consistent, coherent way. Additionally, it can take time before you report domestic violence. And judges often would say, if it was a long time since the incident, it must not be that serious, or they must not really need this domestic violence protection order, because it's been so long since that this has happened. So you really saw this reliance on these internal kind of shortcuts and trying to make these decisions really rapidly when they were faced with really complex information. And it's a unique thing. On these court dockets, the judges are often doing assault hearings, you know, hearings about a neighbor who has a dispute about their dogs. I mean, it's a wide range of things that they're hearing. And then you're throwing in this very complex, nuanced issue. And they have very limited training in intimate partner violence. And so you really saw this coming out when we were talking to them in the interviews. This is just one of the quotes that really highlights if they see that physical evidence. And so I know it's a lot to read, so I'll just go through it quickly. It's really extent of injuries. I mean, that's definitely the primary thing that would make me more likely to grant versus less likely to grant. And she has the black eye, and you see the evidence where she's been bleeding and bruised. I mean, no doubt I'm going to grant the protective order. Versus if I have the same woman, you know, the same facts in front of me, different young woman, no bruises, no nothing, just her word. I still may grant it based on what she said, but obviously the better evidence is with the young lady who has the actual bruises. Now, the role of children was another thing that came up, because when people would describe children being present at, and this is the other issue with the domestic violence protection orders, is that you would report on a single act of domestic violence, when typically it's much more chronic, but you'd have to describe this single incident, and if there were children present at that incident, a judge would feel much more comfortable granting the order because it immediately would bump it up and cross that threshold for them. But additionally, a lot of people, and this is every judge brought this up, is that they're really concerned that people are seeking orders to adjudicate custody rather than actually reporting on a domestic violence, because when you get the 10-day order for the year long, essentially the person who's getting the DVPO retains custody of the children. So it is a way that oftentimes people might this is what the judges are really concerned about. There's not necessarily a lot of evidence to support it. It was very just much their opinion that people are using it as a way of adjudicating custody versus really trying to seek protection from a violent relationship. And so these are, again, some quotes that are going to highlight this. I think it's always, you know, that should be equal. They should be equal, whether there's kids or not, according to law. But if kids are witnessing it, then maybe I would. I mean, pushing in front of a child might bother me more than pushing out in the parking lot where nobody's around. That shouldn't, but that's the way that it is. In a lot of cases I've seen, based upon what they're saying, I know that it's about them getting custody of the children. Yeah, so I guess words to that effect really trigger something in me to let me know that they may or may not be domestic violence at the root of the problem. It's more control for the children's sake. And, I mean, even in this quote, you can really see that reliance on those heuristics, again, that are coming through in the data, and that they're using just these mental shortcuts to really help them guide them in these situations. Now, finally, anticipatory regret. So this was, again, a really conflicting. There was these two things that were affecting these judges, and it is a very difficult decision because when you have that DBPO in place, they can get very concerned that it's going to have negative impact on the defendant, and this is really the concern if the violence isn't occurring, so that, you know, you can be thrown out of your home, your car can be taken away, you can lose your job, you lose access to your children. The judges would often be worried that they would grant the order, and then in a situation where there wasn't violence, and then it's having this really strong negative impact on the defendant. They additionally are really worried that if they don't grant the order, there's going to be continued or escalating violence. So that if they didn't grant this order, something terrible was going to happen. So there's a lot of conflicting worry that these judges have to think about in a very short period of time when they have to make these fairly complex decisions. And this is really the quote, I think, that captures this conflict. You're always worried, I think, either way. Did you get it right? So there are serious consequences either way. I think it's the toughest courtroom that district court judges have. So what do our findings kind of taken together lead us to conclude? Well, it's definitely clear that these judges are employing heuristics. They really are facing these conflicting pressures in their decisions. And additionally, it was clear that the information that's being exchanged is very limited. Oftentimes, they only have that single incident in front of them. So unless the plaintiff brings up the chronic nature of the abuse, it's never going to be entered into the record. So the judge is completely unaware that maybe this is just an isolated incident. So they're really having to base these decisions on very limited information in a short period of time and with very limited training. And so they're going to be using these mental shortcuts to help them with these decisions. So we came up with several recommendations that we think could help mitigate the heuristics that are being used, specifically increased use of intimate partner violence or domestic violence advocates at the courtroom level. They can really help groom the plaintiffs, essentially, so that they can go in knowing that they can bring evidence to support their case, knowing the language that the judges are going to be more receptive to, that's phrased in a way that's similar to the statutes in the way that they're written, so that essentially it limits the heuristics that are needed to use. Additionally, and this is a point that was raised earlier, is that there needs to be much more consistent training. Oftentimes, these judges will be on the stand, I think is the word, for decades, and they have one session on intimate partner violence that takes place when they first are appointed. So there definitely needs to be much more intimate partner violence training that's happening. And then finally, we recommend that they might explore restructuring courts. And as I was mentioning, oftentimes they're looking at these cases that are very disparate from one another. So we were recommending that maybe you could combine the civil and criminal court cases so that they're happening concurrent, because right now they are happening separate. So if you have a civil case, the judge may not know that even there's a criminal trial happening, so they may not grant the order, and then you get a conviction in the criminal case. So there's a lot of stuff happening that's occurring parallel to one another, but they're really not cross-communicating. So additionally, something that's fairly simple to do is to try to put all those domestic violence cases on a single court schedule or docket so that then the judge isn't having to bounce around between topic areas. And additionally, it depends on the county, but you should... We recommend that they research the benefits of having exclusive domestic violence courts because research suggests that that is very helpful and can result in increased granting of domestic violence protection orders. And then finally, I just really would like to thank all the judges that participated, including Judge Buckner, who is the district court judge, who's really just been a champion of this research and is just a fantastic guy. The research team, and then, of course, the Injury Research Prevention Center that paid for this research so that we could have it done. So thank you so much. Well, I mean, it's really hard to disentangle those two things because a lot of heuristics are informed by your previous experiences. So really, it is something that's just kind of builds on one another. Yeah, essentially, it's really trying to capture. We wanted to use a word that could capture both of those things. And in some of the previous studies that we had read, it seems like heuristics could kind of capture both. So really, it was just getting at those mental shortcuts.
In terms of the judge beating his wife, I would suggest you go ask him.
That would get real weird, real quick.
But ask him about their childhood. If you grow up with something and you say, "Well, my dad hit me and mom, but that was because he cared."
Well, it's very interesting though that you bring that point up because there were a few times in the interviews where that kind of language emerged of the judges saying things like, well, you know, when someone steps out of line versus, so you would hear those kind of, and we didn't necessarily probe on their personal behavior, but it's definitely something that's a concern of that there were these patterns, maybe with the judges of their own experiences that were then being reflected in the courtroom.